What is dedication?
The thing that drives me every day as a dad is Dariano. We call him Day-Day for short. Every day he's hungry for something, whether it's attention, affection, knowledge. And there's this huge responsibility in making sure that when he's no longer under my wing, that he's a good person. I want him to be able to sit back one day and go, we worked together, we did a good job.
That's dedication. Find out more at fatherhood.gov. Brought to you by the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services and the Ad Council.
Shop the Sherwin-Williams 4th of July sale and get 30% off paints and stains June 27th through July 7th. With prices starting at $34.29, it's the perfect time to transform your space with color. Whether you're looking to revamp your interior or exterior, we have you covered with bold hues, soothing neutrals, and everything in between. Visit your neighborhood Sherwin-Williams store or shop the sale online. Delivery available on qualifying orders. Click the banner to learn more. Retail sales only. Some exclusions apply. See store for details.
Over the last 7 episodes, we've covered Lee Harvey Oswald's arrival back in the United States up through the day he left to go to New Orleans. That's too much information for just one recap and rebuttals episode. There's no way that we could fit 7 episodes into one recap and rebuttals and do it meaningfully. So what we're going to do is split it in half. This is the first recap and rebuttals of those 7. It's going to cover episodes 39 through 42. And then next week, we'll do another one with friend of the show and NFL football and JFK assassination guru, Michael Lombardi. Today, our guest is Max Good. Max is the director and creator of the documentary film, The Assassination and Mrs. Payne, which looks at the relationship that Ruth Payne had with Marina and Lee Oswald, really trying to answer a question that we have on this podcast, which is, what were Ruth and Michael Payne really up to when it comes to their relationship with the Oswalds? We'll talk to Max about the White Russians, George de Morenschild, and the Paynes coming up next on Solving JFK.
In Dallas, Texas, 3 shots were fired at President Kennedy's motorcade in downtown Dallas. The first reports say that President Kennedy has been seriously wounded by this shooting.
The flash, apparently official, President Kennedy died at 1 p.m. Central Standard Time.
I don't know what this is all about.
Dallas police this morning resumed custody. The man they have formally charged with the assassination of President Kennedy.
I'm just a patsy.
Was Oswald acting alone, or was he a member of a conspiracy? Commission answers, he acted alone.
Max, welcome to the show. Appreciate you coming on, man.
Hey, man. Great to be here. Thanks for having me on.
Right on. And I was mentioning to Max before that when his film came out in 2022, I actually was on vacation and had a chance to watch it 2 times in a row the night it came out. You can ask my wife about that. She was wondering what, because normally I watch something once and I forget about it, but I watched this one 2 times right in a row. So really, really well done, Max. And I've been a fan since before you and I met, and appreciate your work on this topic.
Thank you.
Right on. Well, good. So as we've talked about, this is a recap and rebuttals episode. So we're going to go through really all the disputed issues, because, you know, the whole thing of the JFK assassination is it turns on these inference split points. Well, you could look at it like this, or you could look at it like this. And that's one thing I really appreciate about you, Max. You are by no means a conspiracy guy who's going, oh, well, it has to be this, it has to be. You're a guy who, I guess, suppose now the term is steel manning, but you make the argument for both sides, and it's really not clear ultimately where you land, but I do think you present all the information, and that's kind of what we're trying to do here with the recap and rebuttals. So the very first issue number 1, was Oswald debriefed by the CIA? So this is a real quick one I just wanted to touch on. The CIA says no. That's their position. They never spoke to Oswald when he came back from the Soviet Union. But in 1978, the House Select Committee on Assassinations interviewed a CIA officer named Donald Denicelia, who said that he received a field report from the New York City office about a Marine defector who worked at a radio plant in Minsk and who recently returned to the U.S. with his family. Now, Denicelli's job at the CIA was to monitor technical and industrial progress in the USSR, things like radio and television factories. And that's where Oswald worked in Minsk. So it would make sense that Denicelli would have access to this information and that it's something that, he would remember and care about. But so the CIA says no. We get this one CIA officer who says yes, the CIA did debrief Oswald. But what I think is the most interesting is John Newman, who he's a big JFK assassination author, scholar. He also was the executive assistant to the director of the National Security Agency and spent a lot of time in military intelligence. He was there when the PBS did their Frontline series on Oswald. And Richard Helms, who had been the director of the CIA, was asked whether the CIA debriefed Oswald. And he said to PBS Frontline, no, there was, you know, he basically reinforced the official story. But then Newman asks him off camera, Mr. Director, what would be so bad about the CIA debriefing Oswald? Isn't that your job? Doesn't it look bad when you say that you did not? And then, according to John Newman, who I think is a very credible individual, Helms asked PBS if he could re-record his segment to change the statement to be that the CIA did interview Oswald. Had you ever heard about that before, Max?
Yeah, I was just remembering some of my interview with Peter Dale Scott, and he talked a lot about this issue of whether Oswald was debriefed. And I was just looking at the transcript, actually. And I think there is evidence that he likely was debriefed.
Yeah, and to me, this question, it really doesn't have a ton of bearing on the case other than why is the CIA lying about it? You would think they would say, of course we debriefed him. Yes, you know, and there's no problem with that. But that's kind of, I guess, the angle.
Yeah, there's this character, Spass T. Rakin.
Sure.
You know, yeah. You heard about this guy?
Very familiar with Spass. Yeah.
This seems to be a common thing where all these agencies are trying to wash their hands of Oswald. No, we didn't know about him. There's no blame you can put on us.
Right.
So
Spass T. Rakin in particular, we did look at him, and you know, he was a guy who I always thought, oh, this guy's wearing a black suit and sunglasses. He's just a obvious CIA. But when we zoom into it, I mean, you know, he denies it, which that's a thing a CIA person would do, right? it didn't look like he provided more assistance, in my view, than would have been provided to anybody else by these entities that were in place. Now, what's weird is he had direct correspondence with Alan Dulles. Okay, Spass T. Rakin in his role as this anti-communist group. So that's one where I put on the edge. Like, I don't make a determination. If I don't think it's overwhelming one way or the other, I go, inconclusive. But, you know, that's kind of one more of those interesting things. But I wasn't some of the things that I thought going into this would be a smoking gun ended up being, you know, looking pretty bad for the official story. Some of the things that I thought were bad for the official story end up being kind of explainable once you get all the other information. I'm sure that was probably your experience as well.
Yeah, I agree. And you have to acknowledge those things when they come up, honestly, that, hey, this doesn't pan out. And, you know, some people get a little too attached to each piece of evidence on their side. And if you do that, you lose credibility. You lose your perspective. Not everything is going to support your position.
Absolutely. And if it doesn't, you just have to, maybe your position needs to change, right? So, all right, issue number two. We've got about four or five issues we'll be covering today. Issue number two, the White Russians. So the big question is, were they organic friends of Oswald, or is there some sort of hidden hand at play? Because what we're going to look at here, the theory, which, you know, anybody familiar with the case knows, is that when Oswald got there, George de Morenschild is his handler, and then de Morenschild leaves and hands off Oswald to the Paines, right? That's sort of the story. But there's a missing element in there in between when he first arrives in Dallas and before he meets de Morenschild, and that's the White Russians. So because the de Morenschild meeting, depending on, we'll get to that here in a second, but Depending on which statement from De Morenschildt you believe, it was the White Russians who told him to go see Oswald. In one view, the other view is that it was J. Walton Moore who told him that. So let's talk White Russians real quick. Oswald's road to befriending the White Russians actually starts out with him asking this woman, Annie Smith, at the Texas Employment Commission where he could find people who speak Russian. And then Smith refers Oswald to Peter Gregory. So, you know, this Annie Smith thing, there's nothing on Annie Smith, but we know from when Oswald gets the job at Jagger's Child Stovall that there's a woman named Helen Cunningham who also works for the Texas Employment Commission. And Helen Cunningham was close personal friends with Anna and Teofil Meller. And the Mellers, they're in the middle of that White Russian group. They're right there with George Beau and Peter Gregory. So it is possible that Annie Smith from the Employment Commission was influenced by Cunningham, or that maybe she asked Cunningham, hey, you know, you're friends with all these Russians. Do you know anyone who speaks Russian? And maybe Cunningham potentially could have had a guiding hand. That would have to be the case for basically Oswald being steered into the White Russians, some sort of guiding hand by Cunningham. So anyway, Oswald goes and he speaks to Annie Smith at the Texas Employment Commission and says, hey, I've got this wife that just speaks Russian. It would be nice for her to meet with some fellow Russian speakers. Also looking for someone to type up some notes I've made in Russian. And anyway, Smith introduces Oswald to Peter Gregory. All right. And then Gregory ends up inviting Oswald over for dinner. And he introduces him to George Beau, who's sort of the leader, the elder of the White Russians in Dallas. Now let's talk about George Beau for a second. You know, Beau, aside from being like the oldest one and the sort of, he did seem to be the leader of the White Russians. He had the closest relationship with Oswald. In particular, he would call Oswald every day or every other day after he moved from Fort Worth to Dallas when he was looking for work. So that was, I thought that was a big fact in terms of George Beau. And something I found out about Beau after the episode came out, I've got this this little tidbit here to share. And that's this. George Beau was the accountant for one of the directors of the Republic National Bank. His name was Lewis McNaughton. And that's in a Boston Globe article. Okay, big deal. So, you know, Beau's the accountant for some bank. Who cares? Well, it turns out, per a 2017 New York Times article, that Republic National Bank worked with the CIA to fund projects that were not approved through official legal funding channels. So basically, this bank worked with the CIA for off-book operations. Now, that doesn't mean that everybody who works for this bank is a CIA asset, but the accountant for one of the directors of that bank, you know, that's a little bit closer. So I just throw that out there, not to say that it proves anything, but it's I think worth noting. Couple other things. The CIA also funded the Tolstoy Foundation and the Russian Orthodox Church, both of which the White Russians relied upon for assistance. And that's also from a 1975 Boston Globe article. I guess my question is, if George Beau was Oswald's first handler before De Morenschildt, then Annie Smith somehow would have to be involved in sending Oswald to Peter Gregory. But if not, it kind of looks like Oswald's just hanging out with the White Russians in a way that's serendipitous, which would sort of undermine the claims about De Morenschildt and Payne, because why would, if the CIA really is going to have Oswald with a babysitter and someone managing him, why would they not do that right away? I guess your thoughts on the White Russians and kind of what they were up to vis-a-vis Oswald.
Yeah, I see how you're trying to track if this is all a chess game and the pieces are being put into place, how does that work? I guess in some ways we can't know all the details, but we obviously can trace some suspicious connections here with the White Russians. And of course, the fact that Oswald is this, you know, poor ex-defector, supposed communist, what is he doing with these high-class right-wing Russians?
It
does not make sense.
You asked Ruth at one point in your film, you said, why would Oswald, who's a Marxist, want to hang out with these anti-communist white Russians? It seems like, it'd be like a MAGA person, wanting to hang out with, whoever, an AOC fan, whatever you want to, what do you say? And what I thought was really interesting is that Ruth responded to your question, and her quote was, "Good question. That's not one I asked."
Yep, that's exactly what she said. Uh, she she acknowledged that it was a good question, just like she acknowledged when I say, what about all these connections with your family, all these CIA links and links to the government? Do you see why that might seem suspicious to some people? And she said, yes. But that's all she said. Oswald with these white Russians doesn't make sense to me. It seems that it easily could have been set up to place him in this chain with this chain of people, possibly to try to hide, how he was put in place, like making it a complex chain of people to get to the Paines through several levels, through different white Russians and Doranshil. And I always, you wonder. Wouldn't they think someday people like us are going to be studying this and they're going to see all these obvious suspicious connections? But at the time, probably nobody was thinking about Freedom of Information Act and all these documents coming out, and these people thought their covers were secure, forever possibly. They didn't think in the future. The public's going to know who's a CIA agent and who's not.
I remember reading a quote from Alan Dulles in The Devil's Chessboard, where he they I forget what the context is, but he basically says, in the future, the only people who will have any interest whatsoever in the 27 volumes of evidence, as opposed to the summary report alone, are university professors, and they're going to be on our side anyway.
Yeah, and he says something else like the American people don't read. There's some quote like that, or he doesn't care what's in there because the American people don't read.
Well, if he, it turns out he was mostly right, but not totally. So
Yeah.
that's good. So that's good. All right, let's go to issue number three. What was George de Morenschild's role with Lee Harvey Oswald? So that's a big question. It's a loaded question. Let's kind of unpack. Really, there's two different topics. One is just looking at all of de Morenschild's links and connections, and the other one is looking at the mechanics of his actual relationship with Oswald. So, first on the connections, we know that de Morenschild, first of all, he was anti-communist and he had deep intelligence connections. So de Morenschild worked for French intelligence while he was in America during World War II, and this is actually not that nefarious, because it's like what he did is he went around trying to convince American oil companies to sell oil to France instead of Germany in the lead up to World War II. So, the Germans were getting iffy, let's say, all right? And France was like, hey, you got to sell us that oil. Germany's going to be a problem. So de Morenschild, in that instance, it was probably a pretty easy sell for him, but he did work for French intelligence. Not everybody just starts working for intelligence all of a sudden. De Morenschild had a close personal relationship with J. Walton Moore of the Dallas CIA, to the point where Moore dined at his home on multiple occasions. J. Walton Moore later disputed these ties to de Morenschild in an internal CIA memo, but that memo where he disputed the ties, he says there's only two instances where he saw Oswald, but that expressly left out other documented instances that he himself had documented of. I'm sorry, I said Oswald. I meant de Morenschild. But that leaves out basically J. Walton Moore's memo saying that he only saw de Morenschild these two times, leaves out other documented instances of when he did see de Morenschild. So we know that he's not totally telling the truth in that memo statement. You could, I suppose, believe that J. Walton Moore is telling the truth more so than de Morenschild, who says that he would have him over to eat on multiple occasions. I guess that's sort of one you've got to determine what inference you follow. But certainly J. Walton Moore and De Morenschild knew one another. That's beyond dispute. The next issue, De Morenschild is at the command center for the Bay of Pigs invasion in Guatemala City on the day of the invasion. And that's supposedly during his Latin American walking tour. What are the chances that his Latin American walking tour happens to coincide perfectly with him arriving in the place where they're doing the Bay of Pigs invasion on the day of the invasion? Coincidence, I suppose. I mean, truly, if you're walking, that would be hard to coordinate. They didn't have cell phones. Maybe that one is coincidence, but man, that's a weird one. And then next we've got, okay, so De Morenschild meets with the CIA and military intelligence right before he goes to Haiti. This is in April or May of 1963. And, you know, that meeting, it's not really a pure smoking gun in terms of what was discussed. Like, this is the meeting where we asked De Morenschild how it was going with Oswald. Ha ha ha. What really sort of the story on it is, we knew that De Morenschild's business partner was basically best friends with Papa Doc, the dictator of Haiti. And we wanted to leverage that relationship so that we could, you know, given Haiti's importance and how close it is to Cuba. So, okay, that doesn't prove that De Morenschild was like nefarious CIA, but it does show that he has these contacts and these relationships. So that's the thing from that interaction. Here's another one. This is a big one, if true. Big if true. This one I think is a little bit more cloudy, but it's something. George De Morenschild allegedly went by the alias Philip Harbin. And there's a guy named Herbert Itkin, who's an oil lawyer, who basically, I forget what the exact issue was, but he worked for a law firm that dealt with international business clients. And the client was trying to do something that was against American policy. I forget what it was, but the client was taking a position that was against the policy of the United States. So he reached out, sort of, he was a whistleblower, if you will, and reached out to a connection of his that got him a meeting with Alan Dulles, according to this guy, Itkin. This is all in an FBI report. And anyway, Itkin then says that shortly after that, he met with a man named Philip Harbin, who basically referenced Alan Dulles as the guy that was meeting, as the reason he was there to meet Itkin. And then, by the way, this guy, Philip Harbin, he's in the oil industry. He's like an oil consultant, like a fixer for oil industry. Well, that kind of lines up with what De Morenschild does. But the cherry on top is that there's a guy named William Gaudette, who was a CIA officer. And Gaudette says that says that Philip Harbin was George De Morenschild. So if that's true, then we have a direct line directly from Dulles to De Morenschild. And, you know, you could decide, do you think, first of all, do you believe this one guy who filed one FBI report? Or, you know, there's one FBI report about this story. I don't know. Maybe, maybe not. You've got a CIA officer who's supporting the idea that De Morenschild has this alias. That makes it a lot stronger, but it's not proven, but it's not nothing. Okay. Another connection, George De Morenschild, he had a brother named Dimitri. And by the way, his brother's name was Dimitri von Morenschild, and George De Morenschild, his original name was von, and then he changed it to De. But anyway, Dimitri kept the von. So Dimitri von Morenschild, he started this Russian Review, which is like a paper that studied, you know, Russian policy and Russian politics. And his co-editor was a guy named William Chamberlain. Well, it turns out that William Chamberlain was very close friends with, Alan Dulles. How close? He wrote Alan Dulles 50 letters in his life. Okay. But see, there's starting to be these connections to Dulles, which doesn't prove anything, but we can't ignore them. Okay. Especially as they're all adding up. All right. The next one, De Morenschild knew and dated, depending on who you talk to, Jackie Kennedy's mom in Long Island, New York, when Jackie was a child. This has nothing to do with the assassination at all. I'm not saying it does, but it is a very interesting historical footnote, right? I don't think De Morenschild was time traveling and he's like, well, I set up Oswald. I'm going to go back in time and see if I can date Jackie's mom. You know, like, I don't think that was what was happening. But another connection. He worked with George H.W. Bush. He worked with George H.W. Bush's childhood best friend very closely. He was partners with him, and he met Bush through that. And he also worked with Zapata Oil, Bush's company. We're not going to talk a lot about the whole Bush letter back and forth in this recap and rebuttals. We can. I don't have it as an issue just because it's not really disputed. I mean, DeMornschild thought people were following him. He writes this letter to Bush. Bush acknowledges his existence and acknowledges that they were friends and writes a letter back to him. So it is interesting, but I don't know how much controversy there is. And the last point, and then I'd love to hear your thoughts, Max, in terms of DeMornschild's associations. There's a guy named Joseph Dreyer who was basically working for this American jute development program, trying to get Caribbean nations to grow the crop of jute, which is like, it's like hemp, but used for string and stuff like that. And he says that DeMornschild regularly spoke to Ruth Payne's dad, William Avery Hyde. So if DeMornschild knew Ruth Payne's dad, that is something. Also, DeMornschild was in, we'll talk about that more when we get to Ruth Payne, but all your thoughts on all those connections and associations of George DeMornschild?
Yeah, DeMornschild has always been one of the shadiest characters, as far as I'm concerned. When I first started looking into the JFK assassination, I thought about this is a key. He's right there next to Oswald. And I mean, his CIA connections are undeniable. One of my biggest regrets in the movie, I think, was that I left it a little bit open whether he was, you know, a CIA asset or not. But there actually is a document where they say he was an unpaid informant. You know, they didn't, like, somebody used another term like asset or something like that. But they said, yes, he was an unpaid informant. And yeah, he's obviously connected. There's no denying that. Ruth in the film also, you know, yeah, she acknowledged it. She said, I think it's possible. I said, do you think he had some association with the CIA? And she said, I think it's possible. I mean, you can go into all the details, you know, his brother and the George Bush letter and everything. But I think, you know, the CIA acknowledging in a document that he's an informant for them is really all you need. I've never read his book, I Am a Patsy. I was always a little wary of the things he said, because it's, you know, he's a CIA guy, and you're wondering, is he really going to be telling the truth? I've talked to other researchers who do believe that he wanted to get the truth out there. I don't know. And even his wife, Jean DeMornschild, she gave an interview to the Fort Worth Star-Telegram in May 78, where she said she believed Oswald was an agent of the United States, possibly of the CIA, and she was convinced he didn't kill JFK. And she said, they may get me too, but I'm not afraid. It's about time somebody looked into this thing. So
interesting.
I think the DeMornschilds are worth looking into. I would consider reading his book at this point.
You raised something that I don't have down to talk about, but I think it's related. You just said that DeMornschild may not be telling the truth. And when he spoke to Willem Oltmans, that was one of the things that really hit me, because Oltmans testified to the HSCA, and this is after DeMornschild was dead. And what he said that DeMornschild told him is that Oswald was involved in the assassination, and it was a conspiracy. And I believe he named Cuban exiles and maybe the mafia, but he didn't name the CIA at all. So that's it's just kind of like with the, this is getting way down the road, but, you know, everyone likes to point to the E. Howard Hunt deathbed confession, which is not really a death, not really that much of a confession, and it's not really deathbed either once you zoom into it. But it was always funny to me that he's naming these people, but he's not pointing to people that would have to be involved if those other people he's saying, or it seems like he was protecting the people that he sort of was loyal to.
Yeah, I mean, Hunt is CIA agent, notoriously unreliable, dishonest. You can basically throw that in the garbage if you want. Or you can say, well, hey, there's this argument that no one ever talked. Here's a guy, he's talking. And there are other mm-hmm. examples, plenty of examples of people who have talked, maybe not who are, you know, right involved with the plot, or, you know, there might be questions about whether they were, even if they're claiming to. But yeah, these things are, it's unreliable. And I think part of the game here is making things so confusing for people that they throw up their hands and say, I don't know, this is crazy. And you're never going to discover the truth. It's too muddled in conflicting storylines and lies and disinformation and unreliable people. But I don't think that's true. I think you can get to the truth through documents and statements and reading this stuff. And you don't necessarily have to go super, super deep into the tiniest of the minutiae to understand the thrust of the case, like the important aspects of it.
Right. My theory is that if it's like using the metaphor of putting a puzzle together, there are some things that you can know for sure. Like, for example, I'm persuaded after 7 episodes of medical evidence that there was a shot from the front just because of the 43 doctors. Then you got the autopsy, but then we have all these, this list of evidence, you know, list of witnesses, John Stringer, Sandra Spencer, some other folks. I'm forgetting the guy that did the x-rays. But anyway, we have all this other evidence on the other side. So that, for example, the shot from the front, that's something I feel is pretty clear. Okay, things like that become the corner pieces and the edge pieces. And then the things that are just like by inference and innuendo, you kind of have to fit those in. But if they don't fit the facts that you already know that have been established, then you know, you got to kind of keep taking a swing. So that's kind of my metaphor for it. All right, hey, on DeMoren Schultz, we got one more thing to cover, which is a big question. So the first part, was he related to intelligence? 1,000%. Not, it's beyond dispute. The next question, why did Oswald befriend DeMoren Schultz? And that is much more disputed. So DeMoren Schultz told the Warren Commission that it was either George Beau, hey, there's that name again, or DeMoren Schultz's lawyer, Max Clark, who told him about Oswald. But he also told the Warren Commission that he mentioned Oswald to J. Walton Moore to see if it was all right, if he was hanging out with Oswald, and Moore said it was okay. Moore said something, you know, like, oh, he's just a crazy or something like that. Like, don't worry about him. And then DeMoren Schultz later changed his story when he spoke to Edward Epstein right before he died. And he said that he went to go see Oswald because he thought that J. Walton Moore wanted him to find out more from Oswald about his time in Minsk. So in other words, to sort of debrief Oswald and be helpful to J. Walton Moore. And he did this to help get an oil contract in Haiti. He thought it would be easier to get this contract if he did this favor for his friend from the CIA. And oh, by the way, he did get that contract right afterwards. So, but on the other hand, and this is something we just talked about, DeMoren Schultz also told William Altman's that Oswald was involved in the assassination, but that there was a conspiracy. So it's kind of all over the place. I mean, to me, I would say that DeMoren Schultz's the one who approached Oswald. Oswald didn't approach him. And it doesn't make any sense that he, like, what do they have in common except for the Russian language? Really nothing. So, you know, given all of DeMoren Schultz's contacts, his status as a white Russian, his own statements to Edward Epstein, it looks like he did form a relationship with Oswald at the behest of the CIA. It's just a question of, like, was that relationship just to debrief Oswald and be friends with him and keep an eye on him, or what? Like, I don't know the granular mechanics of what the relationship was. I do think that he did it to get this oil contract that he got, and that he did it to help the CIA, but I don't know what where, because his testimony at the end of the day, it's like he kind of is against Oswald on the General Walker shooting, but he doesn't say that he saw, I'm getting ahead, but he doesn't say that he saw a rifle. His wife saw the rifle. So he doesn't say anything that's completely damning of Oswald, really, other than just talking about how he's a Marxist. I guess your thoughts on all that?
Yeah, well, I think de Moorenschot was just assisting Oswald and Marina from what I understand, kind of helping them. But it's very odd. You would have to assume that Oswald understands that this might be a kind of a arranged friendship, a professional
Right.
relationship going on. One thing about de Moorenschot and Ruth is she says in the movie that she thinks she only met him once at this party, but that's not true. This is one of the few times, and I'd like somebody to catalog them all, the few times where you can catch Ruth in an untruth or a clearly documented false statement.
Sure.
Because in 1967, there was they de Moorenschot discovered a another one of these backyard photos, and it was like in a box of records or something in a storage unit. And I think it was maybe it was the Paines, the Paines records or something. I'm not sure that exactly how this went down, but they had dinner. Michael and Ruth had dinner with the de Moorenschots after this new backyard photo was discovered in 1967. So Ruth either forgot about that or didn't want to talk about it.
Right. De Moorenschot 133C. Yeah, that's the one. It's funny that picture actually. No, it was De Moorenschot 133A. I'm wrong. Okay. Anyway, sorry. I'm like deep into the photograph stuff at the moment. All right. So that's it on De Moorenschot. Now let's talk about De Moorenschot's death real quick, because this is funny. I didn't get very many rebuttals on this episode because I think, the questions aren't on, it doesn't turn on some small fact. It turns on what inference do you make from looking at all these facts. And so it's there's less rebuttals, but the ones that I got the most were about my take on de Moorenschot's death. So let's talk about that really quick. And here's the rebuttal. Matt, for the death of George de Moorenschot, your analysis is good, but for some reason you land on him taking his own life rather than homicide. Why do you totally write off the five beeps that were heard on the machine and the authorities saying that they aren't going to look at the homicide? So, okay, let's look at these facts real quick. Quick recap. De Moorenschot died of a shotgun blast to the head hours after he was visited by HSCA investigator Gayton Fonzie. Now, there was no one home at the time of the shooting except for the housekeeper and the gardener, and neither one of them heard the shots. Heard the shot, singular. Earlier, when he was in Dallas, de Moorenschot had been, vi just let me clarify, he died in Manalapan, Florida, and then actually at the home of one of his ex-wife's sisters who lived on the beach, this beautiful beach house in Manalapan, Florida. But before that, he was in Dallas, and de Moorenschot had chronic bronchitis. So he started seeing this doctor named Dr. Mendoza, who was a new doctor in Dallas, for his chronic bronchitis. Now, we don't know how he was referred to Dr. Mendoza. Jean de Moorenschot says she was referred by someone, but she doesn't remember. And if this whole Dr. Mendoza story is really material to what we're talking about, that fact is important. How does he get into the picture is a real big question. But anyway, Dr. Mendoza he treats the bronchitis and that gets better, but he asked de Moorenschot to keep coming back for continual injections, and he won't share with Jean what these injections are. And then after that, de Moorenschot cuts off the medical care with Dr. Mendoza, and Mendoza skips town and leaves a fake forwarding address. So this guy was never found. He's a ghost. Okay. All right. And then shortly after, believe it or not, DeMorin Schultz's mental health rapidly declined, and he had multiple attempts to take his own life. And that was in the last year before he died. And he eventually was admitted into a mental hospital in Dallas. He also told his daughter weeks before his death that he was contemplating suicide. So I think there are pretty strong arguments to support that, that he took his own life. I have to be careful with the words I use because these stupid platforms will make no one see the video because of one stupid word. Okay. Anyway, it's crazy, but whatever. Anyway, so but there's another side of the coin. All right. And this is what I think a lot of listeners of the podcast probably land at a different place than I land. And that's cool. I want to say that's okay. It's all right. We don't have to agree about every single thing. And the facts to support that, which is a homicide, okay, is this. There's only a couple of things. That is that the woman who owned the house asked her housekeeper to record just the audio only of one of her favorite soap operas because she wasn't going to be home. That audio tape captured the sound of the shotgun blast, but right before the blast, you supposedly also hear five beeps on the tape. And Mark Lane thought that those five beeps were a home security alarm that was popular at the time. And there was also a juror on the coroner's inquest into DeMorin Schultz's death who heard the tape and said, "Hey, wait a minute, that's a home security alarm." Now, what makes this even a little bit more salacious is that the video, the YouTube video that has the audio of this recording has been scrubbed from the internet. So now you cannot find this video anywhere. Okay. There's stuff that's a lot more incriminating to the official story than that particular video. So I'm not saying like that's why it happened, but it is convenient. One of those, oh, isn't that convenient? But anyway, so the other thing is Mark Lane was at the coroner's inquest and he raised this issue with the authorities and they said, "We're not even looking at that. We're not going down that road." So to me, I think the five beeps on this audio that has since disappeared, they do need to be explained. I'm not saying we should just forget about those. I think authorities should chase down any available leads, and I think taking the position of we're not going to look into that for anything is foolish, okay? But I just think given what we know, if I had to bet money on what happened, on what the outcome was, it seems like it's Mendoza influencing DeMorin Schultz's behavior through these unknown injections, and then you've got a pattern of multiple prior attempts. So that's where I land. And please keep listening to the show and don't stop just because of I disagree with you guys about this. It might have been a homicide. There was one other. Give me a witness. Give me the the gardener and the housekeeper going, "I saw some guy going this way," right? Like, give me anything else. I just don't have enough in light of the evidence we do have on the unaliving. Okay. What do you think about this, Max?
Yeah, I didn't know all that about Dr. Mendoza and the prior suicide attempts. Maybe I'd heard about a little of that, but I agree. I think he doesn't have to be murdered for this to be extremely suspicious. I mean, you just provided a lot of grist there for an alternative theory that's just as bad. So I think it's important people don't get so tied to things happening one way and it being the most salacious, obvious, crazy thing every
Right.
time. And yeah, sometimes people kill themselves, and maybe they're driven to do so. Who knows? I know there's other, there's Gary Webb and Mike Rupert and Danny Casolaro and all these other these people where some of the people around them are saying, hey, yeah, they killed themselves. But, people are so steeped in conspiracy that it's just unthinkable that it could have happened that way.
Yeah, no, you're absolutely right. All right, so that's DeMorin Schultz. Let's move on to an area that you know a lot about. which is, the question is, what do we know about the role of Ruth and Michael Payne through the end of April 1963? So there's a lot of information on the Paynes, and there's a lot of stuff you covered in your film that we haven't gotten to yet. So things I'm thinking of, and by the way, spoiler alert for those who aren't looking ahead, the index cards that Buddy Walther found, they were kind of cataloging all of these left wingers in Dallas. The supposed phone call between Michael and Ruth on the day of. There are a few other things that once we get into the fall, we just haven't covered that. So I'm going to focus on basically up through the end of April. Okay.
Hey, everybody. Matt Crumpton here. When I'm not researching, writing, or recording, one of my favorite ways to relax is with federally legal THC from Mood.com. This stuff doesn't come from a lab. It's pesticide-free and grown on American farms. You can get 20% off your first order using the code JFK. One of my go-tos is the functional gummies from Mood.com. These gummies only take 15 minutes to feel the effects, and you can choose all kinds of different moods, from creativity to pain relief to just plain old relaxation. Everything comes right to your door and is discreetly labeled. Best of all, not only is every Mood product backed by a 100-day satisfaction guarantee, you also get 20% off of your first order using code JFK. So head on over to Mood.com and find the functional gummy that matches exactly what you're looking for, and let Mood help you discover your perfect mood. Remember, use code JFK for a 20% discount.
Lowe's knows how to set off your July 4th with savings. Right now, buy one, get one free on select one-coat coverage interior paint via Visa gift card rebate. Plus, get two select 2 or 2.5-quart red, white, and blue annuals for just $10. Hurry, these July 4th deals won't last long. Lowe's, we help, you save. Valid through 7/9. Selection varies by location. While supplies last, excludes Alaska and Hawaii. More terms and restrictions apply. See Lowe's.com/rebates for more details.
But all right, so let's quickly talk about the initial meeting between Marina. And by the way, it's Marina and Lee that are hanging out with Ruth, but Ruth's razor sharp focused on building a relationship with Marina, which makes sense, right? It's not like she's going to be able to build one with Oswald, because first of all, he's a married guy, but more importantly, he's weird and hates everyone. Okay. So that seems to be, a common thread. But all right, what happens is there's this party, and it's at Everett Glover's house, and Everett Glover knew George de Morenschild from actually being a member of the Dallas Figure Skating Club. Ice skating really big in Dallas in the late 50s, I guess. I don't know, maybe it was a Russian thing, but then they stopped hanging out for a while. Then they started playing tennis together in 62 and 63. So that's how de Morenschild knew Everett Glover. Everett Glover knew Ruth Payne because he sang with her at the Unitarian Church, and he says that he knew that she spoke Russian, and he thought, oh, we're going to have these friends of de Morenschild that he invited, and there, you know, Marina is a native Russian speaker who just came here. Wouldn't that be great for Ruth to talk to her? So the official story is there's no coordination whatsoever between de Morenschild and Ruth Payne because they had not met before that time, okay? Now that would be serendipity. And again, if it's serendipity between, you know, the Oswalds just happened to stop hanging out with the de Morenschilds and happened to start hanging out with the Paynes, that kind of undermines the whole CIA conspiracy angle a little bit. So but it may not be, I guess I'm trying to literally see the ties through the fog, but it may have been that they're professionals and they did a good enough job of hiding this. Any sort of invite of Ruth Payne to this Everett Glover party has been denied by Glover, de Morenschild and Payne. So in other words, that only Everett Glover invited Ruth, not George. But remember, the purpose of this party was that he wanted to show his videos again. This dude loves showing his home movies to Morenschild. Oh, you got to see my movies. Yeah, look at this. And so there's that, but then there's also the whole thing of DeMornchild potentially knowing Ruth Payne's dad. And if he knows her dad, then he could get that contact. It's also, he could have put the nudge and just with Everett Glover and said, hey, wouldn't it be good, you know, for the Oswalds to meet other people who speak, you know, it could have been subtle. We don't really know. I guess your thoughts on that first, the Everett Glover party where people sort of call it the handoff between DeMornchild and Payne. Do you, what are your thoughts on that?
Yeah, I've heard, you know, that this part of this party was trying to introduce the Oswalds to, you know, these different people. I mean the whole thing is suspicious, like we were talking about before, with the fact that these you know, white Russians and people, you know, high up in the oil industry in Dallas are just sort of kind of sheltering this young family who are conceivably or assumably they're communists, and
right.
That's the story we're told, right? I mean, were they claiming to be something else along the way? I was never told that.
No. Well, Marina was pretty quiet about it, but now of course she was KGB. We learned earlier from the CIA gives 29 reasons why they thought she was KGB. So that's what they thought. It's hard to tell for sure.
Yeah. It seems on the surface, it seems like this party was set up to transfer the Paynes from DeMornchild, transfer the Oswalds from DeMornchild to the Paynes, and Ruth specifically, you know, to meet Marina, mm-hmm. And yeah, conveniently Michael Payne and Ruth were separated, and there's an open bedroom at her house.
That is something that is convenient, huh? Let's talk about a few topics I want to cover here on Ruth and Michael. So let's talk Ruth's background associations. So first, we have her dad, William Avery Hyde, who worked for, and by the way, I'm from Columbus, Ohio, and the fact that he started out, he was at Nationwide and Nationwide Insurance, and Columbus is where he worked and lived. Ruth is from Columbus, apparently, originally, so that's a crazy connection. But Nationwide put him on loan. And he ended up working for the International Cooperation Association, an affiliate, which is called the Cooperative League of the U.S. He did that in 1957. They're this international group. They're sort of CIA tangential affiliated, but the CIA wasn't actively a part of it. And it's related to the same thing that George DeMornchild was involved with when he went over to Yugoslavia, although it's not exactly the same group. William Avery Hyde also worked for USAID, that's the big one, before and after the JFK assassination. And according to former USAID director at the time, John Gilligan, the USAID was infiltrated from top to bottom with CIA. This is the person who was the director of USAID at the time. One other fact on William Avery Hyde, he was in the OSS, which is a predecessor to the CIA, and he was under consideration for covert use by the CIA in 1957 in Vietnam. They ultimately chose not to use him, but they said that basically he had a positive disposition, that they would use him again if they could. Ruth's sister, Sylvia Hyde Hoke, was a direct W-2 employee of the Central Intelligence Agency. And that came out in 1993. And I saw in your film, Max, that Ruth seemed to dispute that to an extent. She was like, well, maybe she worked for somebody who worked for CIA. It's like, no, she got paid by the CIA. It was on her paycheck. So was that...
I brought it up with her in two different interviews. And mm-hmm. The first time she said, well, she worked for an outfit. She called it an outfit, which is a term for agency or a, you know, spy agency. Okay. But she was unclear about it. Oh. And then she kind of went back and said, oh, maybe something she was working on they could have been interested in. She really didn't want to acknowledge that in any way. I'm not sure if that she feels like there's some law against not revealing a CIA employee's status, or if she feels like she'd be doing something against her sister, who's still alive as far as I know. Sylvia Hoke, I believe all of Ruth's siblings, her brother and her sister and she, are all in their 90s and all still alive.
And you called called Sylvia Hoke, and it's in your film. And I think you spoke to her really quick and asked her if she would comment, and then she hung up. Is that what happened?
Yeah, she said I don't answer questions about that, and then she hung up.
Okay.
She was pretty clear. And of course her husband also worked for USAID, and just in 2017, I think his applications to work for the CIA were declassified, which they're not entirely readable, but they seem to say that he was denied employment by the CIA. Seems to happen to a lot of people.
Let's talk about Michael Payne. So two really big connections on the Michael Payne side. And the first one is his stepdad, Arthur Young, is a Bell helicopter executive. People say he invented Bell helicopter. Really, specifically, he invented the first very popular model of the Bell helicopter and was a, engineer, inventor. He was involved in a lot of stuff, but he didn't invent he didn't do every single one of them, right? But he was kind of the man, certainly at first. And then Bell went on to have the contract. They created the Huey helicopter, which was very big in the Vietnam War, and they made a ton of money on that. So Arthur Young is a higher up at Bell helicopter, and that's in the Dallas area. I don't know if it was in Dallas or Fort Worth, but it's in the area. And he ends up getting Michael Payne a job working at Bell helicopter, and he has this high security clearance due to his stepdad's, really due to his job that he got from his stepdad. Then we have the big one that doesn't prove anything, but it's like, man, are you kidding me? And that is Michael Payne's mother. Okay, so we kind of have to draw some lines here. So his mom's best friend. Okay, that's not that complicated. Everybody can think in your mind, who is your mother's best friend? All right. His mom's best friend was this woman named Mary Bancroft. And Mary Bancroft was Alan Dulles's mistress, during World War II. Now, she wasn't his mistress the whole time. She wasn't his mistress in, the summer of 1963, but she was still close with him. She actually ended up developing a close relationship with Clover, Alan Dulles's wife. And no doubt that there's a relationship between Dulles and Bancroft, and between Bancroft and Michael Payne's mom. So that's one more of those connections. You're like, if it's just one thing, you're like, huh, interesting footnote for history. But when all these things, all these lines keep going back to this guy, Alan Dulles, it's a little strange. Thoughts on those two before I've got a few other ones.
Yeah. Well, I'd like to give a shout out to Bill Simpich. I think you've probably come across his work. He did a series called The 12 Who Built the Oswald Legend.
Yes. I've cited that before.
And, there are two of those focus specifically on the Paynes. Part 7 is the handoff from De Morenschild to the Paynes, and part 11, the Paynes carry the weight. And he's looked into this in really serious detail. So he's always a source you want to go to on the Paynes. He's also he's convinced, and it's what he's shown me is convincing, that this there's a letter in the record that Alan Dulles put in with the Warren Commission, that it was provided by a friend, an anonymous friend of his, and it's who was friends with the Payne family, Michael Payne's mother specifically. And it seems clear that this was written by Mary Bancroft,
Oh, wow.
And she goes into detail about the Payne family, you know, talking about their personal lives and their connections. The fact that the Paynes have these CIA connections on both sides, Michael and Ruth, very suspicious. No one can tell you otherwise.
Right.
No one should be able to tell you otherwise. I wanted to talk about the fact that all the Payne parents can be tied to communism or socialism, which puts them possibly in the record, in the security index, or on some sort of government records as being a risk or being a possible asset with access to those worlds. Now, Ruth's parents were longtime supporters of the socialist candidate, Norman Thomas. Ruth's mom, there was a report generated that Ruth's mom was a communist, or she was claiming to be a communist. Like her neighbor was interviewed and, you know, gave that report. And there's even a document where Michael's mother, Ruth Forbes Payne Young, or whatever you want to call her, she was the original Ruth Payne.
Right.
That was her name. And when she was married to Arthur Young, they were at some party in Maine or something, and they're talking to some admiral or something, and they start going on about how communism is great and it should be the system that takes over America or something. And this guy, you know, talks to the FBI about it. There's a report about that. Michael's father, Lyman Payne, he's a extremely well-known Trotskyist communist socialist, and so this family is connected, and yet they have CIA ties also, and the father is working for the government. Ruth's sister was able to pass, you know, security checks and work for the CIA. It just seems really obvious, like, that these people would be involved in anti-communist work. Also because Ruth acknowledges in the film, and it's, you know, verified that her parents were vehement anti-communists. I mean, or at least they were on the non-communist left, more socialist,
right,
a little bit tamer end of the left. And they were the kind of people who would be valuable to the government as in their connection, their involvement with the left and the socialist,
sure,
world, but their kind of patriotic dedication to fighting Soviet communism. And those are the exact kind of people that were being utilized by the intelligence community in the Cold War.
Right, the old leftist patriot play.
And people, you know, these people going around and, you know, claiming to be communists and stuff, you got to wonder. Michael Payne also, there are reports about him going to the local university, SMU, and kind of provoking students to talk about politics and talking about how he was supporting Cuba and Castro. And it seems like this family was probably heavy anti-communists who were trying to help out their government in fighting,
right,
communism.
Right. Let's talk about a couple more associations. And this is, I mean, these aren't all associations, just sort of additional things that make you go, as a CNC Music Factory would say. There's a guy named Frederick Osborne Jr. When you were talking about Mary Bancroft, the Mary Bancroft letter that Alan Dulles had put in there on behalf of the Paynes, I thought this is what you were going to say. But there's this, have you ever heard of this guy, Frederick Osborne Jr.?
Yeah, they did they were character witnesses for the,
right,
Paynes.
So
yeah.
Frederick and his wife, they were, they're in an FBI report basically as being character witnesses for the Paynes. But what's crazy is Frederick Osborne's father, Frederick Osborne Sr., was a close associate of Alan Dulles. They formed the Crusade for Freedom together at Princeton, and there are numerous communications between Osborne Sr. and Alan Dulles that are now located at the Princeton Library. We talked about Frederick Osborne. Here's one. If you're Jim Garrison supposedly tried to subpoena the tax returns of the Paines in his trial, but he was denied because they were classified. Did you ever ask her about that, or have you ever seen anything on that?
I don't think I asked her about the tax returns. It did occur to me that maybe it would be fun to ask her, oh, do you want to, can you release your tax returns like they've asked, you know, presidential candidates to do? And then I've heard conflicting things that, you know, that the tax returns that are part of the JFK files, they're classified under different laws than the rest of it. It's under IRS privacy laws. And so we're not, supposedly we'll never get those tax returns that are among the JFK files. I've never heard of, you know, totally clear arguments about that, but
I guess it depends on how much you believe Garrison, and some people don't believe Garrison at all. Some people are, you know, believe what he says generally, but because if he was told that they were classified, that's different than that they're not available to you. Classified has like, you know, there's been a national security determination implication to it, which is almost the same thing as saying she's definitely CIA. But I guess that's a little, I mean, is there a chance that that's foggy and it's not stone cold that it was classified? Or,
well, I wonder if Garrison would have had legal access to those tax returns beyond what we might have through the JFK Records Act, because those tax returns are in there. The Paines tax returns are among the remaining classified files that have not been released.
Wow, there's the headline. Now she's still alive, but this is, if it's a matter of public import, you would think that she would go ahead and allow them to be declassified, but whatever. All right, here's another one. When Garrison subpoenaed Marina, and this one is not disputed because we have the transcript, when she testified at the Clay Shaw trial, he asked her if she still hangs out with Ruth Paine, and she said no because the Secret Service said that she's affiliated with the CIA and she should stay away from Ruth.
Yeah.
That's a crazy one.
This is one that I was kind of debating whether to use in the film, because if you read the transcript, it's a little unclear whether Garrison was leading Marina with his questioning, or I'm not sure if it was Garrison personally or one of the other attorneys, but since then, I believe that is basically debunked, and Marina may have actually thought that they were talking about the ACLU. But on the other hand, Marina does say, you know, they ask her a clear question and she does say, yes, I think, you know, they were warning me because she was sympathizing with CIA. No, you could take it both ways, but I wouldn't put too much stock in that anymore.
Okay. Also, it's Marina Oswald. So Marina said all kind of things. I mean, if you believe what Marina Oswald said, then Lee Harvey Oswald's guilty, period. There's no need for us to talk. So, if you believe all of her initial statements and the HSCA, she's changed somewhere around after the movie came out. She changed her the movie JFK Oliver Stone came out. She changed her tone, I think. But
if she could just do an interview and tell everyone where she was, you know, leaned on to lie about certain things, or she made stuff up and come clean, that would be really helpful.
And you got her on the phone, right? You got Marina Oswald on the phone, I believe.
I did. I was really surprised that she answered the phone and talked to me for, you know, 10 minutes or something.
Wow.
She was really nice, really helpful. She said, she wasn't willing to really say anything specific about Ruth, like whether she suspected Ruth or anything like that. I've seen other reports where people talked to her, and she did express suspicion about Ruth, that she thought Ruth was part of a plot.
Wow.
But I think she's very careful about what she says now. I don't think she's really trying to say anything or be in the spotlight at all.
Right. Okay, let's see, I've got four more things here. All right. So we talked about you know, how Ruth and Marina initially met at this Everett Glover party. But one thing that struck me was Ruth's pursuit of a friendship with Marina. So, you know, she writes her letter right away, and then Marina had moved, so she asked, "Can I come see you at your new house?" And then after only five interactions with Marina, Ruth then invites Marina and June to come live at her house. So I thought that was pretty interesting. But the thing is, you can look at that as, oh, wow, look at this, you know, operative trying to, you know, manufacture a relationship quickly. Or you can go, this is somebody that really liked this person. Haven't we all had a friend that the friendship developed quickly and you hung out with a lot? And, you know, how do you know it's not just that? I mean, and some people say that Ruth and, you know, Ruth wanted to have there was a romantic potential relationship between or angle between Ruth and Marina. What are your thoughts on just sort of what Ruth's pursuit says about the situation, if anything?
It does seem kind of forward or kind of aggressive, but it also maybe she just really felt a connection with this woman and she saw that she was in need. She was alone. She didn't speak English well. That's all believable to me. And I think, you know, you can file this information away, but it doesn't prove anything. It can be seen either way. And it's speculation to say, oh, Ruth was obviously, you know, just did this because it was an assignment.
Yes.
You know,
I agree.
Who knows? It could have happened many different ways. It could have been engineered in a way, and still Ruth was doing it out of genuine goodwill or something like that.
One thing that was funny, I saw on Ruth's door, there's a sticker that says, "I stand with Snowden." And it just got me thinking, like, she's still taking these like civil libertarian positions and like wrapping herself in that. Perhaps she believes it completely. But that was interesting to me that, you know, I suppose you could full-throatedly defend the Warren Commission and also be anti-war and whatever, pro-civil liberties, that those people exist. It was just I don't know, that kind of like that was a flag. I was like, wait, what? She likes Edward Snowden?
Yeah, some of those posters and stickers on her window are a little strange. And she says things here and there that sort of hint that she might be more conservative than she lets on. Also in the Thomas Mallon book, Mrs. Payne's Garage, he talks to her about the Vietnam War, and she didn't feel aligned with the anti-Vietnam War movement, which is a little questionable for somebody of her reputation, her Quaker background. And maybe it was too radical, too dirty and hippie or something for her, but yeah, that was a little red flag for me.
Yeah,
and this is total, you know, totally personal, you know, just personal perception, but whenever she talks about JFK and she says she voted for him or this or that, I just never get the sense that she genuinely respected or liked JFK very much.
I guess really my last question is, I got one more. Have you spoken to Ruth since it came out? Like, what's her perception of the film
Her perception of the film is odd. I heard through the grapevine that the quote was that she thought the film was powerfully bad or something, you know, well done, but powerfully awful. I think that was it. Well done, but powerfully awful.
Oh, wow.
And I did meet her with her maybe a year ago or so. The filmmakers who are doing Four Died Trying, you know about that project?
Yes, yes. It's great.
They set up a meeting between me and Ruth, and they filmed it, and it was very awkward, but Ruth held her own. She was unflustered. She was very civil and, you know, very respectful, and we sat down and, you know, talked about it. She just said she thought the movie was biased, but it was well done. Mm-hmm. I think I asked her if she showed the movie at her retirement home, and it was a little unclear, but it sounded like she said yes.
Interesting.
So
interesting.
Yeah, it was nice to get a little closure with Ruth. I you know, I respect her, whatever her role was. I respect her that she's had to deal with such a burden for the last 60 years. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I think you got to treat her like as a human being, no matter what she, you think she right. did, or what you don't think she did. Who knows, maybe before she dies, or maybe she'll leave us a note or something. Mm-hmm. And maybe we'll get a little more information.
Just to kind of wrap up, I mean, it is sort of a prerequisite for there to be a conspiracy that she would have to be involved, because there are so many things in a lot of them haven't happened yet and are, you know, haven't happened before April of 1963. But there are so many things that, you know, this evidence that looks bad against Oswald, most of the bad evidence for him comes from either Marina, her words, or it comes from Ruth Payne or Ruth Payne's house. So,
there's one theory I sometimes think about that kind of absolves Ruth in some way. And that would be that, yes, she did get instructions or was guided into sheltering, babysitting the Oswalds. And she did do some of that stuff. But maybe she really believed that Oswald was guilty. Maybe she was told, along with other people who had that level of knowledge, that he was a double agent, and the Soviets turned him, and he came back and killed the president, and we got to cover it up because we're gonna look terrible, and we got to avoid World War III. Mm-hmm. I mean, I think telling people like that Oswald was a double agent, and, you know, yes, he was working for us, but he went to the Soviet Union, they turned him, that'd be a good way to get people to participate right. in a cover-up.
And it's also true that even if she was a CIA asset, even if she was, you know, on a mission and just fulfilling her orders, that doesn't mean that she knew what was happening or she knew why she was doing what she was told to do. So that doesn't, it's not like she personally, you know, orchestrated all this stuff, if this theory is even true. And I try so hard to be open-minded about the idea that Ruth is innocent. I don't want to say some nice old lady is you know, the conspirator and the murderer of the president, but I think it's better if we talk about like how we're talking about, like, well, we're not saying that it was her idea. We're saying that if this is true, she was a piece of the puzzle towards the bottom and just kind of doing what she was told. And then afterwards had to figure out what she wanted her life to be. And was probably presented with some different options. This is all speculation, but I don't know.
I've only come across a couple researchers who actually would say, yeah, I think Ruth was in on the plot to kill the president. Almost right. Everybody thinks she would have been just a pawn in a compartmentalized piece of the plot. But that would still mean, you know, she's being dishonest to this day, withholding something. And that's my conclusion. You know, I've been, a lot of times I've tried to shy away from sharing what I really think, but I think I'm convinced, 99% that she's withholding something important. And I could go into more detail of like how serious I think her involvement would be, but I think that's all you really need to say. And if she is, her path, to getting that burden off her shoulders would be to tell us all before she dies, or she can leave some record that we will get after she dies.
Well, we'll see what happens. Appreciate you joining us, Max. And, we've got more to come on Ruth Payne in the future. So certainly love to have you on again once we wrap everything up and talk about the second half sometime. It doesn't have to be as long as it was today. This is a long one. Thank you for sticking around and learned some things today. And yeah, it was a great episode, man.
Thanks a lot. It was fun.
All right, cool. Good stuff. Next episode, we will have another recap and rebuttals for episodes 43 through 45 with Michael Lombardi. Talk to you soon.
Lowe's knows that no matter your paint project, saving is at the top of your list. That's why when you shop today, you can buy one, get one free, select Valspar and HGTV Home by Sherwin-Williams one coat coverage interior paints via rebate. Shop these deals in-store or online today at Lowe's. We help. You save. Rebate in form of Visa gift card equal to 100% off the second eligible item purchased before or after applicable discounts, if any. See details. Offer ends 7/9.
Tired of trying diet after diet without results? Mochi Health offers a long-term weight loss solution personalized to your needs. Our board-certified obesity doctors and registered dietitians provide expert guidance to help you succeed. Eligible patients can access custom-formulated GLP-1 medication at an affordable set price delivered monthly. Take our free quiz at joinmochi.com and use code AUDIO40 for $40 off your first month. That's joinmochi.com.